this would not be spoken true. So you go up to somebody's up and he's meditating, and you say, what are you doing? He says, I'm trying to produce my paradise, my Buddha paradise. And the Buddha says, well, any bodhisattva who says that is not speaking truth. Okay? Which means what?
I'm working up bodhisattva on producing my nominal paradise.
Yeah, all right. Okay. If he said that I'm working on producing a paradise which is self-existent, meaning independent of my projections, when I get there, then he's a liar. He's not speaking truth. There's a pun there in the English and in the Tibetan. Not speaking true means what? That's one meaning, but what's the other meaning? He's not speaking truly in the sense of true existence from the thing's own side. Okay? Even those words, I'm working to produce my paradise, are spoken. As we understand them, it's only because we are projecting onto the words. That's a whole subject in Majjhimika. It's a very, very deep subject. Because a lot of the people who criticized Nagarjuna said, well, words have inherent meaning. You know, when you say paradise, it has an inherent meaning. And Nagarjuna says, no, it's a bunch of random sounds, and you are projecting a meaning onto those random sounds. Even words don't have their own meanings. So there's a double entendre there, okay? Now we say Dabbe Shinkan. Say Dabbe.
Dabbe
Shinkan.
Shinkan.
And the short form is Dakshin. Say Dakshin.
Dakshin.
Dabbe means pure. Pure. And Shinkan means realm. Pure realm. And I guess that's where the Japanese schools sometimes get the meaning. That's where they get their word from, that expression. The short name is Dakshin. This means pure field. Field in the sense of a farmer's field. And that's the Buddhist name for heaven or paradise.
Interchange.
Yeah, this is an abbreviation of this. Dakshin. And there are many other names. Gaben, Tushita, Ogmin. There are many, many names of paradises. That's the most general name. Sangekishin, Sangekisa. There's lots of names. So what we're going to do tonight first is discuss specifically how Maitreya, which Buddha?
Future.
He's the next Buddha, okay? He's the future Buddha. How he gets to his Dabbe Shinkan. That's a big subject in the monastery. Sipa is a synonym for samsara. It's like korwa. Sometimes they call it existence. Like the wheel of life is really called Sipa korwa. Tama means final. And Changsen means bodhisattva. So this is a bodhisattva at the final moment of his samsara, of his non-Buddha existence, samsaric life, right? The last moment of his non-Buddhahood. You can say the moment before he becomes enlightened. Okay. And number two, Ganden Lashu. Ganden is that heaven called Ganden. There are a lot of connotations of Ganden. It's Tushira in Sanskrit. It means bliss, the heaven of bliss. Ganden means having bliss. Tosh, the root Tush and Tosh, doesn't mean rear end. It means bliss in Sanskrit. Okay, and Ganden. That's why Tsongkhapa chose it as the name of his home monastery. He founded Ganden Monastery. That was his headquarters for a long time. And then the Galupa sect spread from that. And sometimes the Galupas are called the Gandenbas. And then later he built, his two disciples built Sera and Jebum, and those became the three great monasteries of Lhasa. The combined enrollment before the Chinese attack was over 30,000 monks. Now it's about 50. So Ganden La, Shug means he is staying in Ganden. So at the beginning of this process of becoming enlightened, he's staying in Ganden. The commentaries here, Kedup Denpa Dage, all the commentaries say, look, we can describe the path of seeing, that's not so bad. For us to describe what it's like to reach enlightenment, you know, what are the final moments of enlightenment like? It's very difficult for a human being to imagine, difficult for us to describe. But he says, I'll try. Okay? And that's the process that's here. Okay? So at this point, Maitreya, well, I'm talking about Maitreya, right? He's a bodhisattva in the last moment. He's located in Ganden. Okay. Which I called Rinpoche to ask him this question this afternoon, but I couldn't get a hold of him. If he's in Gan, then I don't see how it can be a Buddha paradise yet. Unless he's visiting, I guess. But that's a long story. I think it is a Buddha paradise, and I think he is visiting. But I don't think he can experience it as a full Buddha paradise. Maybe something like that. Anyway. Say there.
There.
Trupa.
Trupa.
Shan. That's Tibetan class, right? Okay. There means in Ganden. In Ganden paradise. Trupa, you know, I think. Truku is the same thing. Almost. What's a trupa?
Emanation.
An emanation. Okay. Shot means he leaves there. Okay, what it means is he leaves an image of himself there. He leaves a clone of himself there. It's not him. It looks like Maitreya. And that clone continues to stay in Ganden.
And at that moment when he becomes enlightened, he leaves the clone behind.
The moment before. Okay.
So who's in Ganden a moment
before?
The clone or
something? He is. I guess you could say it's 3 moments, okay? He must be the definitive beta. He leaves the clone. He's sitting in meditation, actually, on emptiness at in Ganden. He leaves an emanation in Ganden, and he goes to...
You don't have to write this.
So, Ogmin La.
Ogmin La.
Chukku.
Chukku.
Nudze.
Nudze.
Ogmin is another paradise. It's called Ogmin. All right. Ogmin's below. Min means not. So what does Ogmin mean? It's the highest. It's below none. Okay, Ogmin means a paradise whose name is below none. La Chukku means the Dhammakaya. Dhammakaya consists of what two things? Do you remember? His essence body, meaning the emptiness of the Buddha's mind, mainly. And then what? The Buddha's mind itself. Those two things together are the Dhammakaya, Dhamma body. Lundze means he actualizes, he makes manifest. They do not say here, grow, or develop, or generate. Why not?
Spontaneously appears.
Yeah, emptiness is permanent and unchanging. It can never grow. He achieves it, he brings it about, but you can't say he develops it, or he generates it, or anything like that. That's a difficult question. Actually, what you got in the Dhammakaya is something which is changing, which is what? What part of the Buddha is changing? His mind, okay? It's part of the Dhammakaya. And then his emptiness is what? And this is too much for Monday night. Me too. By the way, we're in the class A. We're all exhausted. Me especially, okay? So keep hanging there, you know. Don't buzz out, all right? We'll make it. You got, like, another... few classes and then you're free for longer than you want, probably. So just work hard, and it's tiring, I know. It's hard to do a whole class. Ogmin means that Chukku Mundaze, so his mind is a changing object. The Buddha's mind is constantly changing as it perceives objects. But his emptiness is unchanging. Together, they are the Dhammakaya. So we say in Buddhist logic that Dhammakaya is unchanging. Therefore, you cannot say he develops, or he grows, or anything like that, the Dhammakaya.
Excuse me, Michael?
Yeah.
I'm a little confused. You said the Buddha's mind is changing.
Yeah.
However, that's a portion of the Dhammakaya.
Right.
And then the Dhammakaya is unchanging.
Yeah, because it has an unchanging element. So anything which has an unchanging element... and a changing element is considered unchanging in Buddhist logic, and you have to prove it.
Okay.
It's an axiom of Buddhist logic, but you have to prove that sometimes too. So then he re-enters the emanation that he left where?
Ganden.
In Ganden.
In meditation on emptiness in Ganden.
It doesn't say specifically. It's very sketchy, and I'm sketchy, and the whole thing is sketchy, and Kedip Dhammadharya says, look, all I can do is try to piece it together from the sutras. You know, we don't have a clear... To try to figure out what happens at the last moment of just before your enlightenment is very difficult.
There's nobody else, right?
Well, I don't know. He did mention in sutras what happened, but it's not very clear exactly. I mean, it's hard to imagine, actually. And then when you get to the 8th chapter of the Abhisamayamkara, Perfection of Wisdom, and you try to read the qualities of the Buddha, they're very difficult. There's Sanghinikyapa, which means beyond our ability to grasp them. Some of the qualities seem impossible. And that's just, you know, it's a non-Buddha trying to imagine what a Buddha is like. Well, I think they're confusing the word. I use, in fact, the word realized to describe an arya, to describe a person who has seen emptiness directly. But sangyawa, which means to become a sangye, which means Buddha, you know, which means to become enlightened, is only at that moment. There's nothing before that. You could call seeing emptiness directly for the first time perhaps an enlightening experience or a realization. And I would call that person realized to distinguish him from social kills, ordinary people, but not before that. Nowhere in the teachings of Indian Buddhism. Unless they mean it to mean a direct perception of emptiness, the first, you know, at the path of seeing. There are qualities of the Buddha. You have to study the 8th chapter of Maitreya's own work, the Abhisamayamkara, and they tell you very clearly his qualities. That what you get when you get enlightened, and there's a big list. It's many pages long. You know. So you re-enter into the womb, and then you Maya. You saw it in little blue. No, he enters his mother's womb, which is the first of his 12 teachings. And then he acts out the other 11 deeds. Why do they say act out? But in Tibetan, the word is tsultema, which means actually to pretend. He was in, according to Mahayana, he was enlightened before he came to this planet, before he came to this earth as Shakyamuni Buddha. He didn't sit under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya and become enlightened yet, according to Mahayana. All Buddhas are enlightened in Oakman. And I asked Rinpoche, you remember Oakman was one of the... Somebody asked me a good question. I think it was Stillwell or somebody else. They said, is everybody's... There were 5 qualities of the enjoyment body. And one of them that he's always got a paradise, Oakman paradise. That's one of his 5 certainties. And I asked Rinpoche, I said, well, does that mean there's all these open paradises running around? I mean, every Buddha has his own open paradise? He said, yes, that's what it means. They're all called open. Okay, and you do have your personal paradise. It's not like you have to share it with somebody else. And it's not like you become one with the other Buddhas. Okay, it's not like you meld together or something like that. Because karma is experienced individually, right? Yeah, they can read. They are kumkin, they're omniscient. And the other Buddha's minds are one of their objects. It's one of they. Since you're omniscient, you know every existing object, and those other Buddha's minds, and their emptinesses, and their physical bodies are all things. So they perceive all of them. Yeah.
But his mother
is on planet Earth. Yeah. What enters the womb is the Nimanakaya, right? It's not the Dharmakaya. So a bunch of things happen. I think one easier way to put this is there's another place. Let me see if I can tell you. I'll tell you a bunch of things that happen at the same time. This is another way they present this in the monastery. A lot of different things happen at the same time and in the first moment of your enlightenment. The first thing is you achieve open paradise.
I mean, your own open is developed you automatically.
You'll read in the reading that the Buddha says he's talking about paradise because he said, look, you got to get enlightened somewhere. You got to get the place ready. By the way, and there's a very beautiful practice called Shingda Jorwa, and I'll write it up there. You can just write it in English now. It's Shingda Jorwa. Shingda Jorwa, Shingda means what? Daxing, same thing. Pure land. Pure realm, paradise. Do you guys object if I say heaven?
No. Doesn't bother you? Okay.
I said that in the translation. Somebody needs it. Shingdat means heaven. And then Jorwa means a practice. And Shindai Jorwa means specific practices you do to achieve your own paradise, the physical place where you're going to stay. So there's a whole list of things you have to do to... there are specific practices you do to achieve your own paradise. And one of them, which Rinpoche is always reminding me, is to keep your room orderly. I ain't going to make it. Apparently, some kind of... As you look at your room and keeping it like Rinpoche's room, so neat that the Dalai Lama could walk in it and feel, you know... I mean, you'd be... It's as clean and neat as you would have it if the Dalai Lama were visiting that morning. And somehow that orderliness, of the karma of being orderly. And also there's a specific karma called Zele Chuingyo, which is in the Abhidhamma, and that's taking care of physical Dharma facilities, like Mr. But if you do it with the right motivation, I'm not doing kasat, which is one of the, what do you call that? Bad livelihood, wrong livelihoods, which is where for a monk to say, you know, oh, it's really great virtue for you guys quitting Dharma centers, you know. We just happen to meet somebody tonight. Not like that. But just to take care of a place physically is one of the Shingdak Jorwas. There's a whole Shingdak Jorwa. It's a really beautiful subject.
Okay.
So what it says here, actually the whole line says, because of your Shingdak Jorwa, you get Ogun. You get your own Ogun. So that was the first thing. I'm going to give you a whole list of things that happen at the same time. You get your own Ogun because you did your practices for getting your own paradise. You directly perceive the totality of knowable things. And there's a reason I say totality. And we'll get to it later.
Arya, knowable?
Excuse me?
Do you mean Arya when you say knowable?
Knowable.
Oh, knowable.
Okay. You directly perceive the totality of knowable things. That's the second thing that happens to you. You reach the what's called, I guess you could say it, the final limit.
I have to check. Michael, when you said Oakman is the highest paradise, does that mean there are paradises that aren't as blissful or good or whatever?
No, that's just what the names mean. Right.
So they're all equivalent.
By the way, most of these have... There are other places with that name in the samsara. Like there is a Gandham, which is a level of the form realm and stuff like that. The Oakman. So there's two of them. There's a duality. There's a pure one and an impure one. Usually. And you reach the pure one, you're not in the infinite.
So are all these various paradises equally desirable to attain, basically?
Yeah, they're all the same thing. They all have the same quality. It's called rochik. It means ekarasa, means they all have the same flavor. They all have the same quality. Oh, okay. That's what I thought. The final limit, what I just said, the final limit, refers to stopping the third suffering. Which is what? What was the third? Do you remember the third? What are the first two sufferings? First suffering is suffering of suffering. Outright suffering. Okay, outright suffering. Backache, headache, mental anguish. Okay. Those are the first suffering. And then the suffering of change, which is the fact that every pleasant experience has a lousy one attached to it. Okay. Everything good you ever get has stapled on to the end of it something miserable. That's the nature of our pleasures. And then third one is what? Third suffering? Pervasive suffering. Which basically means the condition of aging and dying.
I thought it referred to all your aggregates being of the nature where they must suffer in every way.
I think you can say that. And I've seen it explained that way. But the basic is the gashi, gawa da shiwe nezu. Nanyangi wangi gawa da shiwe nezu. Which just basically means getting old. To reach the final limit, which is what? How many things we got now?
Three.
You know all knowable, the totality of knowable things, and you reach the final limit. Good point. And the Galupa monastic textbook here adds a line, which, if you had done it earlier, would have constituted the extreme of peace. And that's part of the definition.
No.
In other words, it would have been reaching a lower nirvana. So it's interesting. It's actually just the plain old nirvana, but it's defined as the one that if you had brought it about earlier, you would have fallen into the extreme of peace. And there's a big debate in the monastery, it's highly just thought of, which is why would anyone want to delay the Buddhahood or Nirvana or anything? Or, no?
No, I was just thinking.
It's a pretty big debate in the monastery.
What you just described then was full Mahayana, not of someone who was Hinayana, achieved Nirvana, and then went on to become a Buddha. This would be someone who was Mahayana.
Yeah, you could say that. That's a good point. We call Menlang Lundamasoma, which means someone who has never been on a lower track, or who has not achieved Nirvana on a lower track. Okay, fourth thing that happens is Chukamundachepa, which means you bring forth your Dharmakaya. What number are we on?
Four.
Okay, we're on five now, right? Okay, number five is you become enlightened towards all dharmas, which I take to mean and must mean the true nature of all dharmas. We say that the Buddha knows the totality and the nature of all things. Totality means he, which we already had, right? Means he sees all existing objects. But being enlightened towards all objects means he also simultaneously directly sees their emptiness of all objects. And only a Buddha can do that. Only a Buddha can simultaneously perceive deceptive reality and ultimate reality at the same time. You know, those Aryas had this thing where they had to come down out of it, and then everything was illusory because they knew they were wrong, and they couldn't help themselves. And only when you reach Buddhahood can you focus on both realities at once. And then, you know, trying to describe the mind that can do that is very difficult. It's projecting and it's not projecting. It's difficult. Yeah. You had a question?
I lost the
question. Good. The physical body, this is what, no, number
six.
Six. I probably have to do these in my guessing exam. What's that?
So,
he is being projected, reality. No,
deceptive
reality came already. It was back in number
two. Number two.
Yeah, number two.
But
by the way, that means
five. He's seeing them. He can see them both.
No, I didn't mean that. Number five says he sees their emptiness.
At the same time.
Number five says
he's seeing the totality of all things. Who's his?
No, all objects in the universe. And emphasizing the relative objects. You want to put it that way? We call Jineta Chu and Jitawa Chu. Number two is he sees the total quantity of all existing things. Number five is he sees the quality of all existing things. How's that?
I still don't understand if he's seeing even a quantity of something.
He sees everything you could count. How about we put it that way?
But they only exist deceptively.
That's true.
So who's? Projection.
His own.
His own.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah. But he sees himself as a Buddha seeing actually what we are projecting. Okay? That's a difficult point. Because he doesn't have to project. He pityingly sees what we are projecting. That's a good point. Okay. That's a difficult point. What number are we on? Six?
Six.
The body of the bodhisattva at the last moment before his enlightenment flips over into the enjoyment body. We had that idea in when we studied Sema, right? That goes ding, 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 reaches the final moment and then flops over into the enjoyment body.
So, in essence, his physical body dies.
It becomes a rainbow body. And the nature of his physical body is very, very interesting. It's like a rainbow. It's not made of atoms, but it's visible. And that's a big debate, too. You can study that something.
I'm sorry,
could
you rephrase the reason they said?
Basically, his samsaric body transforms into a paradisical body, which is visible, but not made up of matter.
Buddhist.
And then other texts say he's like empty like a golden picture. There's nothing inside. There's no guts and no heart and no lungs. It's just a pure rainbow. Okay.
Is it the idea that anybody who's attained a rainbow body is enlightened?
That would be mixing two different sentences. Remember that famous debate we had about? Were you here?
Well, I thought that's what you're talking about. It's not the same.
No. Okay. Similar, but not exactly. And last thing.
Seven.
Number seven.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I can recall you saying that it didn't actually transform.
I didn't say transform. What does he say? He says.
Flips over.
Because it says here, it takes on the condition of if you want a better a verb. It does say transform.
It's like the substance of the sense of our body.
Yeah, transform. Due to your karma, you perceive it as transform.
But the substance itself.
It provides the nirlanka jiva. It provides the what we call the what? The immediate karma. The material karma. Okay, last thing. This is a little tricky, okay? He achieves a cause for what will, at the next moment, become the ability to emanate countless nirmanakaya. I.e., you can't say that in the first moment of his enlightenment, he attained countless emanation bodies that are on all these planets, because that's a result of the long course, of the enjoyment body. The enjoyment body has to send them out. He's got to have the... He only achieves the cause for all the nirmanakaya.
Is the enjoyment body the cause?
It says it's connected to the enjoyment body. I believe the cause is the Dharmakaya. I believe what generates that is the Dharmakaya. The mind. But the cause is tied up with the enjoyment body. The cause is somehow tied to the enjoyment body. And in the next moment, it starts sending out emanations, including one to Earth, into Maya's womb. And apparently this is a pattern for all Buddhas. I mean, it seems like on particular planets, I don't know if the names are the same of the mother and all that, but the basic deeds they do and the basic life they pretend to go through for our benefit are all very similar.
Is this countless millions of emanations going out to appear as the same way as the Buddha did here, or is there just one unique time and place where that particular 11 deeds are acted out?
There's a very tremendous debate about it in the Abhidhamma Kosha. But the Rang Luke, you know, what the final position is that there could be countless planets on which any single Buddha is emanating as you know, a Shakyamuni Buddha going through a whole life and stuff like that. And they could take quite different forms as well.
But
the Chokitoku, the highest physical image of a Buddha that appears on the planet, it always has those 112 marks, signs and marks.
So finally then, is this particular acting out like we saw here on Earth special or unique to when someone first achieves their Buddhahood, or can they have achieved
countless
millions of lives ago and they still make it look like it just happened? So that's one sort of supreme emanation form. Nirmanakaya
you could say that
among many other forms that could go all the way
to you could say the one that came out the second instant after his enlightenment. By the way, this is describing my trail. This is beautiful. They say it's to, first of all, it's the same as the purpose for pretending to die, which is to make us believe that everything is suffering. He goes through Giganashi, he goes through the four sufferings, being born, getting old, getting sick and dying. And he does it for our benefit, to show us a pattern. And then he goes through this whole thing of pretending to follow a wrong spiritual path for a while, and then pretending to discover the right one, and then pretending to sit under the Bodhi tree all night, and then pretending to become enlightened, and then pretend, you know, going through this whole pattern. The real activity that he does, which is really not like a movie, is teaching. That's his main activity. That's the main activity of a Buddha, is to teach people. He goes through all that other stuff in order to get a group of people there to teach. Yeah. Except in this sense that, I mean, there are Buddhas, there are worlds where they're not ripe for Mahayana, and there's worlds, there are many, many worlds where they're not ripe for Sankhya. People are just not fit for Sankhya. So it's supposed to be extremely rare. They say this is like, there's a flower, there's a kind of flower in India that blooms once every 1,000 years or something. And we're in this particular era, you know, we've reached this. We aren't comparable to that flower blooming because we live in a world where country is
dark. Do we know when Maitreya is coming?
I think there is a prediction. I don't have it. I can look it up. I'm sure there's different dates mentioned. Let's do one more short thing and then we'll take a break. Homework has a question that says, why doesn't the truth of suffering exist in the Buddha paradigm? And then there is this debate in the Buddhist scriptures where people say, well, Ogun is just another place. How come it's not the truth of suffering? Every single location in our world is the truth of suffering in the sense of being the reality of suffering. Every single location on this planet is equally total suffering. So why isn't Oak Min suffering? It's just another place, right?
But the suffering, the samsara, is a state of mind. It's not a physical place.
No, there's nirchugi, nirdanchugi korwa. Nirgi korwa means the physical place where samsara occurs, and then chugi korwa means the inhabitants of that place. It can be divided into two. Dunyal Demba, the truth of suffering, is divided into two, the place and the beings.
So the answer to that question is
before. Yeah, I mean, somebody comes up in a debate, you know, the Buddhist texts are designed as debates, and somebody comes up and says, well, Ogun is a place, so it must be covered with suffering. Suffering must imbue it, the way it imbues every single locality on the planet of Earth. Why not?
Then the Buddha would have to have suffering when he came here.
Because it's an emanation of the mind.
That's true. Well, the main thing comes in the cause. Well, the causes are different. Totally different.
You know the non-Buddhist.
What's the cause of a suffering place? There are two classic causes. Two things that make our world, if you are to like me, poopy. You know? There's only two things that you got to get rid of. There's one of them came from the past and is screwing up our present world. And one of them we have now is screwing up our future world. If you could get rid of those two, you'd be in paradise forever. And in fact, you must get rid of those two. So what are they?
Karma.
One is karma. That's what's happened in the past that is making your world lousy now. And what now do you have that's going to make your future world lousy? Your mental afflictions. The root of them being
ignorance
or believing that things are not your projection, basically. If you got, it's a very simple path, you know, when you think about it. If you could find a way to get rid of your old karma, and if you could find a way to get rid of your mental afflictions, which are the only thing that can create new karma, then you'd be in paradise. You'd be in paradise tonight. And you can do it. And that's the whole purpose to have a class, actually. You can really do it. Huh? What's that?
The only thing that can create new bad karma.
Well, there's dirty good karma and there's clean good karma. There's pure good karma and there's unclean
karma.
Good karma created with ignorance is called, we call dirty good karma. But that's a long story.
It's black and white, right?
Basically. So.
Causes all things.
But those are the two things that cause our, every locality on planet Earth, even the Bahamas, even Barbados, even the beach on Barbados, is created by those two things. So you must suffer there. When you go there, you have to suffer. It must be lousy. what are the two causes of paradise? One is called Munlam and one is called Gewa. What's Munlam?
Something
fast. Yeah, Munlam is prayer. Like the Munlam festival in Hasa, it's called prayer. Mm-hmm. Prayer means as Buddhas, before they become Buddhas, collect virtue, they start to, what do you call it? They start to do an action plan, you know. I'll become Shakyamuni Buddha. I'd like to be on planet Earth. I'd like to teach Tantra. You know, that's what I'm going to shoot for. It's sort of a statement of intention. It's what we call it.
Mission
statement, yeah. Corporate mission statement. It's a mission statement. It really is. It's a munlong. If the virtue is done with that munlong, and then virtue, good deeds. So, the texts say if a place is created by Munlam and Gewa, by those virtuous intentions and those virtues, it won't be the truth of suffering. And if it's created by karma and kleshas, you must suffer there. And that's the difference between Oakman and the place beyond, and New York City as we now experience it. Where will Oakman be? I mean, this really irritates me when they write books about where is Shambhala, you know, like, take a left turn, a turn in my office, you gotta get in the spaceship there, you gotta get over that mountain. And where will Oakman be?
Yeah.
I mean, truly. It will just be wherever you happen to be when you finish those two causes. Because the object will just change for you. No, I mean, it'll be New York City, actually, if you don't move out of here before you're enlightened.
So, the purpose for Ogmen, really, isn't it for the Buddha to interact with the Mahayana Aryas, right?
Yeah, and by the way, I don't mean to imply that it is now.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not trying to say that the New York City is a paradise now, and you have a problem and you can't recognize it. That's not. You will make New York City into paradise by being virtuous, because it's empty. And only because of them.
So if the Ogmen is the place for the Buddha to interact and teach Mahayana Aryas, at that time for the Buddha it will be pure, but at that same time, by the very nature, Mahayana Aryas or Bodhisattvas who are not yet Buddhists will still have some perception of...
They will be getting old as they sit in Oakland and listen to the Buddha.
Right.
Yeah. That's
and
true.
Vice versa. When the Buddha
That's
comes right. here, for us, we're getting old.
Yeah.
And for that
yeah.
Buddha, they appear
old,
to
be. No.
Getting very old. Okay, let's take a break, man.
Mental situation.
Just stop thinking.
What's the second best thing?
Shakma. Good deed.
No. Mental affliction.
Good deed. Empty, meditate on empty.
See emptiness, that's all
yeah, right.
Why didn't the guy get angry when Miss Anilan, Miss, what's your name? Please sit down. What the second? Why did he get angry, the guy that was getting his fingers cut off? I mean, a lot of people said because he saw emptiness, come on.
Didn't have a concept of his own self.
And because you can't have that mental affliction and emptiness at the same time.
You can't, you can't. They are, yeah. It would just be, it would be crazy to understand that this guy is cutting off my fingers because I had a bad thought in the past, and then allow yourself a bad thought. It would be some kind of insanity. And we do it all the time. We live like that. And then wisdom has to get the upper hand. And finally it's got to click in during those intermittent moments at work when someone's yelling at you. It has to turn on at the right time. So there's a knowledge, but then there has to be a sheshin, which is awareness. You have to be able to turn it on at the right time. A lot of us understand what I just said, but when the minute somebody yells at work, you get into this defensive mode and everything just melts away. It happens to me every day, several times. And you just forget everything and you get angry again. So that's how you get rid of the mental afflictions. But how do you get rid of your past bad karma?
Purification.
It's the four forces,
okay?
You have to do a Buddhist purification. Buddhist purification is very, very beautiful. It works. You can remove the power of your old karma. It's really, really nice. it's very, very powerful, and that's why they call it forces. It's really powerful. If you really do try it, it'll be very satisfying for you. Basis force, they explain, is what gets you back on your feet. You fell down, you did a bad deed, and what's the floor? You know, what do you push against to get back up on your feet? What helps you get back up on your feet? What helps you recover? Is taking refuge and generating bodhicitta. There's one prayer for that, right? Sangyechunam, Sangyechunam. Refuge means, what does going for refuge mean? I think one of the main meanings would be to, you know, in the morning you think, today something bad will happen to me, something difficult will come, and I will not get sucked into to reacting the old way. I will see the emptiness of it. I'll see that it's my own projection, and I will definitely not create the new projection. That, and to me, that's the essence of taking refuge. I believe that's the essence of taking refuge. That's the only thing that can protect you. That's the only refuge. That is protection. That thought is protection. Buddha can't do anything. Buddha can be, Dalai Lama can stand next to you and you can get your fingers cut off. And he can't help you. There's nothing he can do. There's nothing Lord Buddha could do when his whole family was slaughtered. He just could stand there. And there's nothing. It's only this thought that can protect you. This understanding can protect you. Knowledge can protect you. And then bodhicitta is that the main idea here is that you say you're working for the good of all sentient beings. And you say you're going to give up your own desires and devote yourself to making sure other people's wishes are fulfilled. And then you get jealous the minute they give somebody a position at work, right? And then Pamoka said, what a joke, you know? You can't even stand someone getting this lousy little samsaric position at work. You know, what would happen if they became a Buddha? You'd probably really get mad, right? And I do it all the time. I catch myself all the time. I get jealous of other Dharma teachers. It's very funny. Okay. Basis force. Second one is, this is what actually destroys the force of bad deeds, and that's regret. Let's say intelligent regret, and then how it gives you a result. And that's what we call karma. And if you explain it clearly to somebody through the perceptual process, it's very acceptable, very reasonable, very logical. And then you have to think, you know, today I got angry. And despite myself, and despite my present, despite the fact that it's against my present wishes, I have indelibly planted a thing in my mind stream. I did it. It's there. It's going to ripen. I got no choice now. You know, it's just some kind of knowledge that you understand the process, you understood that you perceived that deed, and that is now planted in your mental stream. Period. It's now stained on your mental stream, and it must come back. It will come back. And just understanding that process. You know, the minute you see yourself doing a bad deed, that's it. It's too late. You can't take it back then. It's planted. It stained your mind stream, and it will give its result. And it will be similar to the cause, which all results are. And it will be bad. Because you can't get a good result from a bad cause. That's impossible too. It's just physics. So it's just intelligent regret means, oh man, I screwed up. You know, I planted it. It is planted. I can't go back to mindstream of 3 p.m. today and take it out. It's too late. You have to stop it before you plant it. What's that? You get half the result. No, if you catch yourself halfway through a bad deed,
yeah,
or a bad thought,
yeah,
the first part of the bad thought, you get a bad result from it. And then you get a really big virtue from stopping yourself. And that's the essence of all morality. You know, I remember Art saying once that if you really think about it, there has to be this process of temptation or almost falling,
mm-hmm,
to really define a virtue of avoiding a bad deed. You have to come close to a bad deed before you can say, I really did the virtue of avoiding it.
If you did something bad and you realize you did something bad and you try to fix it.
That's what these four forces are.
Okay.
this is really, I mean, this is really the one that, that does the most. Well, I shouldn't say that, because that's a short one. But, I mean, a lot of people say, oh, you're Buddhist. In fact, Hinayana would say, oh, your four forces are like the morning after pill, you know. You want to have it both ways, you know. You want to do something bad the night before and have everything okay the next day if you do your four forces, you know. I've heard people say that. I've heard that them say that the Mahayana has psychologically invented this thing to make you better, people better, and it doesn't really work. And wouldn't it be silly to say that you could go around and do any bad deed you want and then just do your four forces, you know, and not worry about it? Which would have, it would seem to be like that if the third one weren't this. The third one means you don't do it again.
Is that like the intent to restrain yourself from doing it again?
We'll talk about it. No, no, it's not doing it again.
That really doesn't do anything unless you. I mean, obviously.
Yeah. You can only have the night after pill one time. You can only use it once. Then it ain't worth much, right? I mean, we'll talk about this, but mainly, if you're doing a good purification, if you're really doing Buddhist purification well, you're pretty much trying to attain a state where you just never do that thing again. Now, many books say you would be a liar if you said you'd never do it again, if it's a habitual bad deed that you have. And we all have our own, and they're different for each person, depending on whether you're a desire or anger side. We all have our particular flavors, favorite flavors. And I have mine, you have yours. You know what it is, I know what mine is. And you have to work on that one. You work on your worst one first, and you try to avoid it. And I've broken mine before I finished my confession ceremony. You know, mentally. And I've caught myself doing that. So the scriptures all say don't add lying to the list of crimes, you know. Set yourself a goal, a time limit. Okay? It says, I will, you know, set yourself a reasonable goal that you can actually watch yourself for that time period. It can be 10 minutes. It can be 24 hours. It could be 2 weeks. But set yourself a doable, an achievable time limit. You know, I for the next 24 hours swear I will not do this thing. Stop yourself. That's how you build up to being able to stop it completely. And you, if you really try to purify a bad deed, a bad habit that you have, you'll have tremendous battles. There'll be tremendous battles. Your life will be a whole series of wars, and you will take many casualties. You know, and the books say that. They describe it like that. You know, before you finally win, there'll be many bad days. And you have to expect that. But you must fight the battle. It's a very glorious, it is the ultimate battle. And you must do it. You must try. You can't just say, oh, I can't do it, or you know, I'll do that tomorrow. Or it's very proper, and it's one of the most, I don't know, meaningful human activities to fight against your bad habits. And you must do it. And sooner or later you'll win. But you'll have many bad days, and you'll fail many times. But in the end, you win. And the Bodhisattva says, you know, nobody who goes into a big battle and slays Goliath doesn't come out with any scratches. You know, you have bad days. You will have bad days. You will screw up. But you got to go back again and do it again. And then sooner or later you win. So you have to start. That's restraining yourself. That's the essence of confession, I mean, really, purification. Because what happens finally? You just don't do it anymore. Okay? And that's, you know, you have one personal bad habit. Number four. Color, what's a nice word for makeup? Or something to make up for it. They're all after. I'll just say makeup activity. Okay, I don't know. you figure out something to make up for it. Okay, I don't know. You figure out a nice.
Repay the debt.
Yeah, it is 10 Hail Marys. Okay. No, it's something that you choose, some symbolic activity, or actually, it can be symbolic or actual, okay? And I'll explain what. I mean, we have a friend out in New Jersey who was in Vietnam, student Rinpoche's, He sprayed the jungle with machine gun fire in a firefight. He doesn't know if he hit anybody. So he came to Rinpoche and says, I might have killed somebody, I don't know. So Rinpoche said, you know, I happen to know that you have two sheep in your backyard that your father's keeping to eat. And I want you to buy them from your father and keep them alive till they die a natural death. Turns out sheep live a lot longer than you would guess. I think they lived for about 18 years. And he took care of them. And then they died a natural death. And that, I mean, that was a symbolic activity. But there is also an actual activity. The highest activity to make up for what you did is to study the perfection of wisdom. It's to study how to perceive emptiness under the influence of bodhisattva. What's that? It's some kind of activity to make up for what you did. Okay, if you do these four correctly, if you do them properly, it is stated in the sutras, and I've seen it, and I've read it recently in the last few days. It's there. It is stated by the Buddha himself that a karma that, in fact, it's stated in the heart, in the Diamond Cutter. You're going to have it in your reading, I think. If you do these properly, then a karma which would have taken you to the lower birth, would have taken you to hell, you can experience in this life as a headache or something. And that's the example given in the scriptures. It means if you do a good purification, what will be happening to you?
You'll get an effective headache.
You'll be going around and getting a lot of headaches. It's worth it, right? By the way, so read. Got your reading?
Yeah.
Page 6, last English on the page. And then we'll stop. That's the last thing. Anila, read it? Yes. Page 6. And here. Anila, here. The English on the bottom. In the dark.
Also, any son or daughter of noble family who takes up a sutra like this, or who holds it, or reads it, or comprehends it fully, will suffer. They will suffer intensely.
Okay. Why?
Hard to understand.
Why? Why, if you study the Diamond Cutter, it's a heavy purification. It's a very intense purification. Because the highest purification is to study emptiness. The highest act of purification is to study emptiness. By the way, when you get into the Tantra, you study Rajasattva purification. It's very, very powerful. Very, very holy. Very great. And I hope we can do that someday. But in the meantime, what makes the understanding of emptiness so powerful as a purification? What's understanding emptiness got to do with not doing that deed? Yeah, it's a direct antidote. If you know emptiness, you're not going to get angry at the guy who's cutting your fingers off, much less the guy at work who says a small bad word to you. You know, that's the whole idea. And only if you understand emptiness will you ever reach that state. Yeah.
Why are you going to suffer after
this bitter? It says here... Oh, that just got intensely. I don't know.
Oh, dear.
That was a headache. I've seen Dharma students, I know Robin maybe saw, in India, when we had very intense Dharma classes, and the Dalai Lama's two teachers were there, Dalai Lama was there, all these high lamas were there, and people went there from the U.S., and they lived there, and they gave up their whole lives and stayed there, and then some of them got terrible, terrible things happened. And it was just very obvious that something was going on, you know, because there would be horrible incidents. People would burn up, or people would get deadly diseases, or people would fall off the cliffs. It was really intense. But I think we're shooting for the headache.
After falling off.
I'd like one more part of this reading, page 5, and then we really will stop. Qigong, right?
Sure.
At the bottom in the dark.
And I tell you further, O Subhuti, any place where this sutra is taught thereby becomes a place worthy of the offerings of the entire world with its gods and men and demigods. It becomes a place which is worthy of their prostrations and worthy of their circumambulations. That place becomes something like a stupa.
So this little 39-foot hole is
it's
hereby holy ground. It seriously is. If you think about the whole United States, the Dhammakaya Sutra is probably just being taught here at this moment. And it really is holy ground. If you have any inkling of what the subject matter is, then it became it's holy ground now. Because, you know, a group of people attain something close to understanding it.
So it's not something like this.
He really means like a stupa in the sense of
holy ground.
Holy ground.
But it is holy ground.
It is
something
holy. Yeah, not just like. That's a good point. It is holy ground. Because I hope you can carry after we move to our bigger quarters.
Yeah.
Right, Mrs. Holdworth? Okay. Mr. Kyle.
Sonam yeshe le jumwe, jampa kuni topa shu.